Campus FM presents a talk organized by Palazzo Falson Historic House Museum in collaboration with the Department of History of Art, entitled Investigating the Water Management Systems of Palazzo Falson, the Civitas and Select Rural Areas. This talk is delivered by Mr. Keith Buhajar.
The title of today's lecture is Investigating the Water Management Systems of Palazzo Falson, the Civitas and Select Rural Areas. The lecturer is Keith Buhajar. Keith Buhajar is an MA graduate in archaeology at the University of Malta, specializing in Maltese medieval and early modern cave settlements and their related water management systems. Currently reading for a PhD in his research centers around Maltese late medieval settlement distribution and water management systems in Malta. Mr. Buhajar is a visiting lecturer in Paleo-Christian and Medieval Archaeology at the Department of Classics and Archaeology at the University of Malta. Research interests include Mediterranean, North African and Near Eastern water management systems, troglodytism and Mediterranean settlement location and distribution. The lecture has been organized by Palazzo Falson Historic House Museum in conjunction with the University of Malta with the History of Art Department at the University. Thank you. Over to you, Keith.
So, good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for attending this morning's lecture in such encouraging numbers. So, in the first instance, the topic, which is investigating the water management systems of Palazzo Falson, the Civitas, and select rural areas, will actually lead us to explore the water management setup, the geological setup, of the Maltese Islands and what actually makes possible the water harvesting techniques that I'll be mentioning in this morning's lecture. So, in the first instance, we need to actually define water management, which is the ability of making provision for the ability of an artificial water supply in order to supplement or substitute natural precipitation. And when it comes to considering the investigation of water management systems within a local context and even within a much broader context, one has to think a little bit about the fact that water availability often determines the rise and the decline of past civilizations. And when it comes to taking a closer look at the local scenario, the emergent situation is an increasingly important picture where settlements were relying basically on the water management supply, on the water management systems, which were located either immediately within a settlement or in very close proximity to a settlement in particular. And when it comes to considering water systems, one has to also think about the notion that water would be feeding agriculture, would be being used in agriculture, and also within a settlement context. One general problem when it comes to discussing water management systems within a local context would be the dating of such systems, because the dating is unfortunately very problematic, in the sense that we're dealing with water systems which were used for centuries on end, and each particular utilization phase would have left its own imprint on such a system, and therefore, in the absence of archaeological stratified deposits, dating would be a very difficult element. And the dates I will be proposing in the concluding phase of this lecture might be subject to revision in a future stage of my research. So I'll be speaking about works in progress. So I want to make that very clear. And this lecture today would not have been possible if I was not roped in a few years back by Dr. Timothy Gambin into the Malta Cisterns project. It was a project which was a joint venture between California Polytechnic, the Aurora Foundation, and the Marine Resource Development Foundation, and which brought over to Malta an experimental remote-operated vehicle, photographs of which I'll be projecting at a slightly later stage. And this ROV, remote-operated vehicle, was actually of crucial importance when it came to investigated restricted spaces, spaces which we could not investigate under normal circumstances. And this ROV actually provided us with video footage, other data, which part of which I'll be analyzing and presenting to you this morning. So we can't speak about water management systems without defining a well from a system, because I'll be constantly referring to both wells and systems throughout the course of this lecture. And when we're dealing with a well, the most apt way to define a well would be man's attempt to obtain water from the earth vertically below the spot where it is required when it is not obviously present at the surface. And therefore, when dealing with a well, one has to here clarify the fact that we're dealing with the tapping of an aquifer, the tapping of a water table, a water table which would be present below the surface level. Therefore, in order for this to be possible, one has to sink a shaft, a vertical shaft, down into the ground, and the depth of the shaft would actually be determined by the depth of the aquifer. We know of a handful of wells which are located in the Medina and Rabat area, and for instance, taking the area behind the Roman Domus, where we've got both cisterns and wells, the wells which were investigated there during the course of the 1920s and 30s are located at a depth of about 9 to 12 meters, so that would be the depth of the aquifer at that particular part of Rabat. And wells are the most ancient hydrological system. Wells appeared, it seems, before cisterns came into use. And what is intriguing with wells, and it's a feature which unfortunately doesn't aid their dating, is that since antiquities, the shaft of wells were either circular, rectangular, or square-shaped. And very frequently, they would have been furnished or fitted with handholds and footholds just to make it possible to actually reach the bottom, the base of the shaft, which was actually tapping the aquifer. And one has to also mention the fact that since antiquity, wells were, generally speaking, referred to cisterns. So wherever it was possible, it was a well which was being excavated and not a cistern. And one of the reasons might have been that a well might have furnished a settlement or might have furnished a household with a fresher water supply and more abundant water supply. The wells which we've got in Malta are mostly speaking perennial wells, and therefore they would not dry out during the arid summer months. When dealing with cisterns, on the other hand, a cistern can be compared to a tank, a subterranean water tank or an above-ground water tank aimed at harvesting runoff surface rainwater or collected rainwater. So cisterns can be either rock excavated, as I've mentioned beforehand, or masonry built above ground level. But since antiquity, it seems that the rock excavated cisterns were preferred to the above ground cisterns. One possibility being that the above ground cisterns would have required constant maintenance, and they would not have been a permanent feature such as the rock excavated ones. And what is really fascinating with cistern technology is the fact that it is such a simple technology to harness that cisterns can actually be excavated with very little technical expertise. And therefore, it was a concept which could be grasped by local communities, and even a family could most probably excavate a cistern, line it with mortar in order to make it watertight. So cistern technology was also widely available. Now, when it comes to taking a closer look at the Maltese geological stratigraphy, Maltese strata are sedimentary formation. That means that all Maltese deposits actually formed in an underwater environment, and they would date to the Oligo-Miocene period of the Tertiary era. And therefore, we're dealing with rocks which would date to around 30 to 6 million years before present. And I want you to actually observe the distribution of upper coralline limestone deposits which are located to the north and the western sector of Malta. And I'm pointing this out simply because of the fact that this particular geology would condition a particular type of water management which would be geared towards the excavation of both wells and cisterns, but mainly speaking wells. Whilst in the central area and the eastern and southern parts of Malta, we've got the predominant geological deposit, which would be Globigerina. And therefore, all settlements in this section of Malta would mainly be geared to harvesting water by means of cisterns. So I'm pointing this out just to lead you to realize how important geology would be in conditioning men's behavior when it comes to water management. Now, looking at the geological profile, a geological cross-section of the Maltese Islands, we've got here two main aquifers. And I'm here referring to the purged aquifer, which actually is a technical term which is referring to the water deposits which are collecting above the blue clay outcrops. And then we've got the mean sea level aquifer. Now, when it comes to Globigerina deposits and the Globigerina plains of Malta, quite interestingly, there is only one place in the southeastern section of Malta which contains upper Corolla limestone outcrops, and that's the area known as Tassananard, which is sandwiched in between Kalkara and Shaira, the Shaira Tahazabar. And it's only that area which contains a perished aquifer in the southern area of Malta. But turning our attention back to the Globigerina plains and to the mean sea level aquifer, one has to here mention the fact that this aquifer, which occupies about 150 square kilometers below Malta, below our feet, was actually an aquifer which was discovered only in the course of the 1850s. And therefore, since antiquity till the 1850s, people inhabiting Malta had no idea about the existence of the mean sea level water table. It is only the purged aquifer and the purged aquifer sources which were actually being made use of. This does not mean that accidentally the mean sea level aquifer would not have been tapped. In actual fact, I've got evidence in hand to show that in a few instances it was indeed tapped, mainly in the medieval period. But this was an accidental occurrence, and people were never actually understanding the concept of a mass of fresh water which was floating above salt water at a mean sea level. So the usage of the mean sea level aquifer would only have been an accidental occurrence. And I'm displaying this photograph, which I've taken of in the whereabouts of Tapenello in the limits of Imjar, simply to show you the geological profile one would encounter when it comes to dealing with the north and western sections of Malta. So we're mainly dealing with an upper Corolla limestone plateau, which is a permeable rock deposit, so water can pass through, but water would then be actually reaching the impermeable blue clay. And it is the blue clay which gives rise to the presence of a means of a purged aquifer. So the purged water table in this particular instance would be located at more or less this level here. Now, just a brief note about Mediterranean climate. Malta is typically Mediterranean climate, and therefore we can expect to have an annual rainfall of about 568 millimeters. But one has to realize that rainfall is erratic, and therefore this is just the mean average. And for instance, we know that rainfall is quite reliable when it comes to rain, which precipitation which takes place in between September and November, where flash floods are quite common, but rainfall would tend to become progressively decrease when it comes to the spring months. And as you can notice, we have also got 3 months where rainfall is particularly absent, and these are June, July, and August. Now, when it comes to climatic shifts since antiquity, this is actually a subject of much controversy and debate. But basing myself on current research, it seems that even though there were minor climatic shifts since antiquity, that is, since the Roman period, it seems that the climate in the Mediterranean region was not appreciably much different. So, therefore, such rainfall data can hold for the medieval period and probably for 2 millennia ago as well. Now, when it comes to homing in onto the Mdina area, so notice how Mdina is actually located on one of the edges, on the easternmost edge of the Rabat Tingli uplands. The predominant geological deposit at Mdina would be upper Corolla limestone. And therefore, at Mvina, below our feet, we've got present the perched water table. So this was greatly influential when conditioning with the water management systems that would be practiced within such a context. And therefore, within the context of Mvina, we know that we can find both cisterns and wells. And I have already mentioned, for instance, a handful of wells which was found within a Roman site in the area behind the Roman Domus. Now, this plan I've compiled on data which I've obtained from the Malta Resource Authority by consultation with the 1940s water data sheets, and it's just I'm presenting this particular plan which I've compiled just to give an idea about the water sources which are present within and the area around Mvina, and these are the officially recorded water sources. So I'm sure that the broader picture would be much different, would consist of a much larger number of wells which would actually be present in the area within and the area around Mvina. But when it comes to the dating of such water features, that is once more a problem, simply because of the fact that the 1940s water data sheets simply refer to, for instance, the water features as an old spring, an old shaft. So a spring is possibly being derived from a well. A shaft can't possibly be dated, unfortunately, in the absence of archaeological stratification or archaeological deposits. And also notice how record 2626 here also mentions that a gallery was actually constructed in 1933. So we're speaking about water systems which would be dating to a variety of periods, of different periods. But for the scope of today's lecture, I'll be mainly speaking about water management systems which were investigated at Vilena Pellis, at Tringuanes, and at Palazzo Falson. So, looking at the equipment which was used in order to make such investigation possible, we're dealing with a remote-operated vehicle, or a remote-operated submersible, which is of an extremely small size. And the equipment mainly consists of a central camera. It consists of a propulsion, two propulsion units, which also contain the illumination source, the halogen lamps. And also notice how the video ray, the ROV, is actually connected to the surface and piloted by means of this umbilical cord, which provides the ROV with its power source, and it also is important with transmitting data back to the surface. And the unit is actually piloted by means of this operational console, which also is fitted with a monitor, just to be able to pilot and guide the ROV accordingly. And data would actually be stored in a series of portable computers, and data by data, I actually mean the video footage, but not only video footage, because in one of the later sessions, the ROV was also actually fitted with sonar equipment. So therefore, sonar data could furnish us with a plan of the subterranean system which was being investigated. Now, when it comes to Vilena Pellis, this was one of the first sites to actually be investigated. And, of course, the dating of the cistern being investigated is quite problematic, is quite difficult to establish. But when dealing with Vilena Pellis, one has to keep in mind that it was built on the rock-excavated remains of a 13th-century structure, a 13th-century castle, which was securely mentioned in the 1241 AD documentation. And this is in actual fact a reconstruction of the structure by Stephen Spiteri. We know that the 1241 castle had a centimolo, an animal-operated mill, and in 1413, and probably long before that, the castle was the residence of the Capitanus Civitatis, the captain of the city. And it survived until 1453, when it was dismantled by direct orders of King Alfonso V. And it is likely that part of the dungeons that still serve, the part of the cellars that still survive can be tentatively identified with the dungeons of the original structure. So the same might apply to the actual cistern. Now, when it comes to the footage of the cistern investigation which was provided to us, by means of the ROV. This is the camera while it was still being lowered into the cistern itself. The camera is now immersed in water, but what is unfortunate about the investigation of this particular cistern is the fact that the water level within the cistern was too shallow, and that did not provide the ROV with the necessary autonomy it needed in order to be able to be piloted through the different areas of the cistern. So, unfortunately, there was not much data in that respect which could be gathered by the investigation of this cistern in such a manner. And the lack of water in cisterns or in wells is unfortunately a limiting factor when it comes to such a project. So the camera is here being lifted out of the water. It is being swung round by means of the umbilical cord. And what is interesting is the fact that in the video footage, you should be able to see right now a square-headed doorway, which is probably an extension of that particular cistern which is being investigated. And this is one particular feature which seems to be quite common when it comes to cisterns being investigated within the context of MDINA, in the sense that it seems that interconnected or interlinked cisterns are quite common. From the video footage I have analyzed, this is a recurrent feature, it seems. So the camera is just being lifted out of the cistern, and that's particularly it. So, and when it comes to, therefore, investigating cisterns, you can notice that such footage does not provide us with a plan of the actual cistern. A plan would be very difficult to determine when it comes to using simply video footage. And therefore, in one of the subsequent sessions of the cisterns project, the ROV was furnished with sonar data, and this is the image which can be provided by means of such a sonar. This consists of the investigation of a cistern in Inguanes seat in MDINA, and notice how once more we are seemingly dealing with a series of interconnected cisterns. There are mainly two interconnected cisterns, probably three. And what is also significant and important about sonar data is the fact that notice how data is being transmitted in concentric circles. So if this was the center point for the ROV, for the location of the ROV, we can also calculate the approximate dimension of the cistern using sonar data, simply because of the fact that we know that this line, this diameter, is of 1.5 meters in length. So the approximate dimensions can also be calculated using this particular method. Now, when it comes to the investigation of the Palazzo Falson cisterns or wells, there are two water systems which were actually investigated. One is located in the courtyard, and in actual fact it's a cistern. Another water system is located in the ticketing office at Palazzo Falson. So this is the location of the courtyard cistern. It's located immediately opposite from the room in which we're located at present. And notice the very narrow nature of the shaft which gives access to the cistern. It's only through the use of such an ROV which this water system could actually be investigated. And this is the footage for the investigation of the cistern. I'm just going to show you snippets of it because unfortunately it's too long, but it would give you an idea of the cistern's interior. So this is just the camera while it's being prepared and checked. It will soon be lowered down into the actual cistern. And notice how in the initial stages, in the uppermost stages of the shaft, we're mainly dealing with what seems to be a masonry lined shaft, rectangular shaft, which would revert to a rock-cut shaft at a lower stage, at a lower level. And I'm going to skip to another section of the footage. And this would be the ROV, which is fully immersed with water. Unfortunately, the video footage would not be clear in some instances. But you can notice the umbilical cord, which is present here. You can notice that there is a rectangular opening into the actual, into part of the actual cistern, and this would be the sonar scan, the sonar image provided by the actual ROV. So notice how we are essentially dealing with what seems to be a bell-shaped cistern, which contains excavated recesses, which might be a later extension to the actual cistern. The possible use of such rock cut spaces would be to increase the water storage capacity of the cistern in question. But the most interesting cistern or well, which was actually investigated, is located within the ticketing office at Palazzo Falzon. It can only be accessed by means of this rectangular or square-shaped trapdoor here, which would give access to this circular shaft, this circular rock-cut shaft. And you can notice the water's reflection at the bottom of the shaft. So this is the footage for the investigation of the shaft. What is really interesting is the fact that we're dealing with a circular shaft, a circular rock excavated shaft, which at a lower level reverts into a rectangular rock excavated shaft. And in turn, it is the rectangular shaft which is giving access to the water source. So we're still dealing with the stage where the camera is still being lowered into the shaft of the water system. So what is interesting is the fact that the camera was seemingly lowered into a circular bell-shaped cistern, which was connected by means of a corridor to an adjoining cistern, which would be more or less located beneath the road, immediately fronting the main facade of Palazzo Falzon. But just to help you get a better idea of what I'm speaking about, so this would be the Palazzo Falzon cistern. This would be the cistern which is located immediately outside Palazzo Falzon. This would be the corridor which would be interconnecting both cisterns. But what is rather intriguing and rather interesting with the investigation of this cistern is the fact that notice how we've got a very narrow corridor which seemingly interconnects the passageway connecting both cisterns together. And this leads me to believe that we're dealing with an instance where a water system which was formerly conceived as being a cistern was at a later stage actually used as a well, because very probably we might be dealing with a water gallery, a water tunnel which happened to either accidentally or purposely interconnect through or pass through the cisterns at Palazzo Falzon, and therefore we're not dealing any longer, it seems, with a water tank which was aimed at storing rainwater, but now we're dealing with a device which was aimed at tapping the aquifer. And if this should be the case, such a water system would look very similar to the one I'm projecting on screen. I've taken this photograph from Tassanti, which is located quite close to the limits of Imjar, and notice how we're dealing with a very narrow passageway, which would be about 60 to 80 centimeters wide. It would be wide enough to allow the passage of a single person. It would be about 1 to 1.5 meters high. And notice how at the very base of the shaft, we've got a rock-excavated water canal, the aim of which is to tap the aquifer and channel the tapped water to the outside of the gallery system. And this is how the innermost section of the water system would actually look like. This is the place where the water table, the perched water table, is actually being tapped, and this is the canal which is channeling that water through the use of gravity to the gallery exterior, and this would be one of the gallery inhabitants, which can be quite plentiful in certain instances. And this would be a simplified diagram which is aimed at giving you an idea of how such galleries would actually look like. So we're practically dealing with a very narrow canal, which can sometimes have a series of shafts which would be linking them to the surface. And such galleries would have first appeared around 800 BC in the region around Persia. And they would have been called Anat or Kanat or Kanawat. If you're in North Africa, they would also be called Foggara, quite probably. And such water systems appear to have reached the north coast of Africa at around the first century AD, because they were quite well-known devices during this period of time in the territory which today would be equivalent to Libya and Egypt. The period or the date when such systems would have been introduced into Malta remains largely unknown. My working hypothesis would suggest the 12th or 13th centuries, where possibly such technology would have filtered into Malta locally through neighboring Sicily, where I've also investigated similar water systems. When it comes to the local galleries, most of such systems do not contain any shafts, but I have investigated a handful of galleries which in actual fact contain shafts. And this might be the case with also Mdina. This is how such a water system would look from the outside, so notice how you will just be presented with a very narrow doorway, which would be the starting point of the gallery. This would be the inside of this particular gallery in the Jnin Tabaldu, located in the limits of Dingli. And what is also particularly interesting with this particular photograph is the fact that this masonry wall has been constructed for the purpose of increasing the water level within the gallery. So this wall is in actual fact acting as a dam. So the water level behind the wall would be higher than the water level at the front part of the gallery. And when it comes to Mdina, I know, for instance, that there is a water gallery which I've investigated very close to the Surta Deredin. So the red dot would locate the exact location of the identified and the partly investigated water gallery. And I suspect that there are two other water galleries in the northern bastions, beneath the northern bastions of Mdina. But what is really ingenuous about this system is the fact that the water gallery would be tunneling below Mdina. So very probably, if shafts should be located, and if what we've got at the ticketing office of Palazzo Falson is a shaft, that would be quite an excellent system by which you've got direct access to your water source from within the settlement. So that means that even during times of siege, you won't run out of water, simply because of the fact that you're tapping the perched aquifer, you've got a well, you're not dealing with a cistern, and therefore you can obtain water directly from within your settlement. Now, there is much more research which has to be carried out in this respect, but I really suspect that what we're dealing with in the ticketing office of Palazzo Falson would be a series of systems which, at a later stage, which actually have been converted into use as a well. And such a conversion of wells into cisterns, or a cistern into well, is not completely unknown of in archaeology. For instance, we've got a settlement in Sicily, which is Morgantina, which is located quite close to Enna, which is a central location in Sicily, where Greek period wells were at a later stage, possibly because of the lowering of the water table, converted into cisterns. At a later stage, the cisterns were once more converted into wells. So such conversions in use in between a well and a cistern and vice versa is not completely unknown of. And the same model would apply to the citadel in Gozo, where, for instance, I have investigated a water gallery which tunnels beneath the citadel, and the triangle also possibly represents another water system which might be another water gallery. And looking at what we find in the countryside areas around Mdina, a spectacular case in point would be with a room, which is a river valley which would be intersected with Hazrum here. And these are the probably late medieval settlements which line the various sides of the valley. So we've got Arzeria, San Jacobo, Tabaldu, Simblia, El Attara, and Tashire. And most of these settlements were troglodytic settlements, very probably in their beginning. So this is just a detail, a general view of the Sanjagbu settlement. So notice how we're dealing with a partly rock excavated settlement, and this would be the upper coralline limestone layer. But what is really significant with this upper coralline limestone layer, and this would be the type of geology I would expect to find also at Mbina, is the fact that it is very brittle. It is a very brittle deposit. It is not hard to excavate, as one usually tends to think when it comes to dealing with upper coralline limestone deposits. And it's technically referred to as the Imtarfa member. And the water table would be more or less located at this particular level. So notice how once more we're dealing with a settlement which would be located immediately above the water source, and the water gallery, which would be giving direct access to the aquifer, would be located at a slightly lower level, but at a higher level than the terraced fields, because the system here would dictate that a series of masonry canals would be channeling the water tapped by the gallery to a lower level in the valley system. And galleries would be opened and closed accordingly to which field would need to be irrigated. So this would be the location of the various water galleries at Peterroom. I can add a few more to these today. They had escaped my attention when I had first compiled this plan. And notice how each settlement would have a number of water galleries which would be located close by. And therefore notice how we're dealing with massive human intervention. The original water source, which flowed through the valley, was by means of the water galleries tapped at a higher level. And therefore, it allows agriculture, gravity-fed agriculture, and therefore all one needs to do is to open and close a series of masonry canals in order to be able to irrigate the fields which need to be watered. And such water systems also increase the value of the land. In the first instance, the Maltese language distinguishes between the irrigated and the non-irrigated landscape. We've got the Sa'wi and the Bal. The Sa'wi would be the irrigated landscape. And such land which have a much higher economical value because of the fact that the presence of water galleries of this type would allow the extension of the growing season well into the summer months. So instead of being able to rely on two crops per year, having a water gallery in your field would mean that you've got a third growing season. You can grow a third crop during the summer months. And when it comes to such water galleries within a rural context, they are sometimes fronted by a water reservoir, by either a partly masonry built reservoir or a rock cut reservoir. And this is the Tal Attara water gallery. This gives you a general view of the gallery. This gives you a detail of the gallery entrance. You've got a rock cut, a rock excavated water canal, which is transporting the water out from the gallery in order to store it in the fronting reservoir. And this is a plan of the same system of the Tal Attara water gallery. So this is the section, the inside section of the gallery. In actual fact, I have never actually managed to investigate this whole water system simply because of the fact that the water passage would be too narrow to continue investigating. But notice how the water would be led to pass through a series of water settling vats, and then the water would be channeled into reservoirs E and D. D would be a subterranean water storage tank. And just to conclude today's lecture, I'm going to be taking another look at one other water gallery, which is located in another area outside Rabat, immediately outside Rabat, known as Witlimu or Tasananard. And this water gallery is this time seemingly intimately connected with a cave church. A cave church which in its current semblance can be tentatively dated to around the 15th century AD. Even though I would suggest that the gallery would be older, slightly older than this date. And the, in relationship to the cave church, the water gallery would be located at more or less this stage here. And this is just a general view of the actual cave church interior. The cave church is completely excavated into the Imtarfa member deposit. And this is the inside of the water gallery. So notice how this time we're dealing with a subterranean water reservoir. So notice how this water reservoir is actually, this wall here is actually increasing the level of the water within the gallery, and this is the actual gallery access point. And we have also investigated this water system by means of the ROV, and in actual fact, The investigation proved to be highly interesting and disappointing at the same time, simply because of the fact that the gallery was so deep, it was over 91 meters deep, that we ran out of cables, so the exterior part, the interior part, the innermost part of the gallery could not be investigated at all. So that would be that would provide much scope for continuing investigating this gallery at a later stage, should the project continue. So this would be the water reservoir, the dam, which is actually increasing the level of the gallery. This would be the point where the camera has been inserted in the water. And I'll just skip forward just to give you an idea of how the gallery would actually look like from the interior. So the camera is now within the water gallery, and notice how there's a lot of sedimentation on the gallery floor. But what is also interesting is the fact that notice that one can still actually make out the traces of the original water canal, the original rock cut water canal. And its presence is very indicative, simply because of the fact that we're dealing with a situation where very probably the original gallery was conceived as being a passageway such as the one I had showed you initially at Tassanti, where you had a dry water gallery and the water was only made to flow through the shaft in the base of the gallery system. And the current setup is probably the result of later alterations. It's probably the result of the enlarging works taking place in the outermost section of the gallery in order to make space for the water reservoir, the construction of the reservoir wall, which is also damming and increasing the water level within the gallery system, and the current hydrological setup by which the water would be actually feeding the various fields which make use of this water for this irrigation. So, as I repeat, in order to conclude, this presentation forms part of works which are still in progress. There is still much more research to be done in this respect, but currently, taking note of the general landscape, taking note of the location of the galleries, I tend to actually associate such water systems with the 12th or 13th century AD, and therefore we're dealing with a late medieval water management system. I've taken a look at several water systems in Sicily, and more or less, I think their dating should be equivalent to the ones we find in Malta. In Sicily, such water galleries were securely mentioned by the 14th century AD, so probably they were present within Sicily slightly before this date. So, thank you very much.
You have just listened to a talk organized by Palazzo Falson Historic House Museum in collaboration with the Department of History of Art, entitled Investigating the Water Management Systems of Palazzo Falson, the Civitas and Select Rural Areas. This talk was delivered by Mr. Keith Bohajar.